Good afternoon. I like a little response. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hey, there we go. There we go. I'm so glad someone said that was a great ad, a good ask. And I just, as a member of the board of directors for the Boston Book Festival, I'm Callie Crossley, have to add a little. Thank you. Thank you. I have to add something to the ask. While you're sitting enjoying the fabulousness of James Sullivan and Bonnie Siegler, you can text book and donate any amount, because we are really trying to expand this festival and keep it going and keeping it as free as possible. So we take any donations in any amount. So do what you are moved to do. This session is called Resist, Signs and Songs of Protest. And I couldn't be more excited. I asked to do this session because these two are going to bring us some really exciting information. Bonnie's going first, so let me give you a little bit about her. Bonnie, okay. Isn't it Bonnie first?
It's fine, yes.
No,
no, right. It is. You're right. First.
It was going to be. No, it's you first then. Let's rewind. James is going first. James Sullivan is a writer, freelance journalist, editor, music, and cultural critic, and he's currently a contributor to the Boston Globe and has also been an editor for Rolling Stone, a critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, consultant for Pandora, and reviewer for Entertainment Weekly. He's a programmer and moderator for the Newburyport Documentary Festival and founder and co-organizer for Lit Crawl Boston. The important thing is he knows what he's talking about. His recent release is Which Side Are You On? And it's an anecdotal history of America's progressive movements and the music that accompanied them. Library Journal says the book is an engaging title which should awaken nostalgia in those of us of a certain age and introduce new generations to these musical catalysts for social change. James Sullivan.
Thank you, Sally. Great, thank you. Thank you, Callie. Thanks for saying that we're fabulousness. And thanks, Bonnie, for being here and sharing the stage with me. So Callie basically just said everything I was going to say about it to introduce myself, but that's fine. I will just reiterate that I am one of the founders and organizers of Lit Crawl Boston, which is actually affiliated with the book festival. So those of you who are not familiar with it, keep an eye out for it. We will have our fourth event coming up this coming spring in 2020. So that's a one-night annual literary event that's sort of fun and, seat-of-the-pants type of literary event with authors doing game shows and music and all kinds of fun stuff. So keep an eye out for that. And if you're subscribed to any of the Boston Book Festival social media stuff, you'll see stuff about that, and hope to see you there. So as Callie mentioned, well, she said, you know, most of my journalistic history. I will just mention that this is my fifth book. The others include a biography of George Carlin, one of James Brown, and a social history of blue jeans. So what I've enjoyed saying until this book came out was that my books are about comedy, sports, music, and pants. This book, the idea for Which Side Are You On, came to me probably about 10 years ago during the Occupy Wall Street movement. And what I was thinking at the time was I've been a music critic for years. I did work for Rolling Stone as an editor for several years. My family and I were in San Francisco for 10 years or so, mid-90s to about 2004. And I was the music critic at the San Francisco Chronicle there, and I still do a lot of feature stories for the Globe. Oh, I should say, but speaking of the Globe, I often say this at events like this. I'm James Sullivan. If any of you came to see Jim Sullivan, who used to write for the Globe, he left about 15 years ago, and coincidentally, I started contributing to the Globe about 15 years ago, and we've been getting confused every single day since then. So I'll say it up front, if any of you were expecting to see Jim Sullivan or happen to be a friend of his, it's okay to get up and leave now. But, you know, I would love to keep you in the room if you're willing. So we live on the North Shore, and there's actually a guy at the Daily Newspaper also named Jim Sullivan, a third guy. So, I mean, it's Boston. Too many Sullies. So I'll go back to what I was talking about the origin of the idea for the book. It's been about 10 years in the making. Because I have been and still am a music journalist, I've always been interested in the ways that music coincides with whatever's going on in the contemporary culture, politically and socially. So during the Occupy Wall Street movement, I was especially struck by the fact that there seemed to be, you know, there were we all saw lots of events happening around the country, in particular in Zuccotti Park and near Wall Street in New York City. And there were a number of news articles at the time saying, this is all great, there's this new spirit of activism, kind of feels like the 60s, but where's the music? And if you were watching the sort of daily reports about what was going on at the Occupy Wall Street events, there was plenty of music. There were young musicians who were sort of unknowns showing up to share their music. There were hip-hop artists who were known showing up to share their music. And there were folkies and, you know, rock stars from the 60s showing up to share old songs, like Crosby and Nash, for instance, showing up at the park one day to play a couple of their old songs that sort of constituted protest music. So to my mind, I'm thinking, why are they saying there's no music? I think maybe the underlying idea behind the fact that people think there is no protest music today is that during the height of the protest era, when most of us, if we were around at the time, would have considered, if somebody said, what's a protest song? You'd say, well, it's Bob Dylan, Blowing in the Wind. It's Pete Seeger. You know, it's, you know, We Shall Overcome. It's Joan Baez. And that's all true, but there's a lot of other styles of protest music, types of protest music. To my mind, basically every style of music under the sun, not just folk music, has provided us with ideas of social protest. And so I was struck by the fact that there were so many stories being written, you know, where's all the protest music? And I sort of felt like, well, it's right under your nose if you're looking for it. So that's been sort of in the back of my mind for years. A few years ago, a couple things happened politically in this country that sort of made me feel that were sort of inspiring plenty of protest episodes and marches and demonstrations. And it sort of felt like the time was right to write this book, so I did. I think maybe one of the key reasons that the that people think that there is no more protest music is that we live in a much more fragmented culture, obviously, now. It's sort of stating the obvious to say that whereas when Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind was on the radio in the 1960s, it was on a pop station that everybody in the country was listening to. There were a handful of pop stations in every market, major market in the country, and they were all playing the same thing. They were all playing basically the top 40. And there were three nightly news networks, and that was it. And now, obviously, we have had an explosion of media. Every one of us has our own little silo of interests and what we listen to, and you know, you have your Spotify favorites and playlists, and I have mine, and Callie has hers. And so we can all find our music in a million different places, on YouTube and on Apple Music and on Spotify and on Pandora, and you can still buy it, obviously. So it's just a much more fragmented culture, and it's really hard to get traction on a mainstream scale for a protest song. Having said that, there have been plenty of examples in recent years of that happening. Just as a, for instance, Kendrick Lamar's song, All Right, which when the protests were happening in Ferguson outside of St. Louis a handful of years ago about Black Lives Matter, Kendrick's song, All Right, became sort of the street anthem, just a chant that brought people together and gave them something to feel connected with while they were protesting. And, you know, that was a popular song before it became a protest anthem, and that's a lot of what's in this book. A lot of songs that were not necessarily written specifically as the idea that, you know, I'm mad about something in the world and I want to write about it. In some cases, they were just more relationship-based, or, you know, I mean, people were mad to write angry enough to write these songs, but they weren't necessarily written in a spirit of this is going to be an anthem for a protest movement. So what I tried to do with the book was show that there are, in fact, so many different kinds of music that or every kind of music has some version of its own protest involved. So to my mind, the blues women of the 1920s were sort of the first feminists. They were, Ma Rainey, Bessie Smith. They were singing songs from the point of view of strong, independent women who, weren't going to let a man tell them how to live their lives. And obviously, blues music in general was written as a certain kind of protest against the prevailing culture in America 100 years ago. Rock and roll, to my mind, it was born out of a spirit of protest in a certain way, in that young people, until the end of the World War II era, really didn't have a voice of their own. Historically speaking, there was really no such thing as teenagers until after World War II. Teenagers were young adults who were either still in school or were, had finished school and were prepared to join the workforce and contribute monetarily, financially to the family. And there was no in between. And then after World War II, when the country sort of exploded into affluence, the affluence that we often see in the sort of, hunky-dory pictures of the 1950s, kids suddenly had disposable income and leisure time to themselves and felt like for the first time they had independence outside of the family and away from their parents. So rock and roll erupted at that time as a sort of expression on the behalf of kids, saying, you know what, we have minds of our own, we can think for ourselves, we don't need you telling us how to behave and what to do. Hip-hop, obviously, is another great example of a style of music that arose in part out of protest against the prevailing culture. And even, to my mind, disco, same. I mean, I have a chapter in the book about gay rights and disco. There are a number of early disco songs, and just the very fact of disco existing, that there was suddenly a place after, centuries of no place for gay men and women to go. Now there was, and they bonded over the music. And there were songs that were explicitly about gay rights, that were gay rights anthems or became gay rights anthems, but there were also plenty of songs that were not explicit, but were implicitly a form of protest. So what I've done at events, speaking about my book, is kind of talk about a few of the songs that I focus on. What I did was picked 10 or so issues that we've seen progress in over the course of the last century of American history. Some are obvious: civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, the anti-violence movement, the nonviolence movement. And some are a little less so, the free speech movement of the 1960s that began in Berkeley and became a campus issue across the country. And the environmental movement, obviously. So each chapter in the book is about one of those issues, and then I picked 10 or so, roughly 10 songs in each chapter to focus on, to show how the issue was brought to the attention of the mainstream, in part through the music. So what I've done is kind of focused on a bunch of the songs in my book and played little snippets of them, which I'm going to do now, but I'm just going to do a couple of the songs because I need to let Bonnie have her time, too. So otherwise we'd be here all night because there's 100 songs in the book. So I'll just start with this, a brief snippet of this. Okay. I was going to say, does anybody not recognize it? But I don't want to embarrass you. So that, of course, is Jimi Hendrix's version of the Star-Spangled Banner at Woodstock in 1969. And so I'm just going to read very briefly like the first page of my book. Though this book is about the power of words, the American protest song that spoke the loudest may be the one that was played without them. When Jimi Hendrix rung the notes of the Star-Spangled Banner from his white Fender Stratocaster from the Woodstock stage on a breaking Monday morning in August 1969, he bombarded the melody with eruptions of feedback. Those amplified sound effects echoed the war that was tearing apart the country of Vietnam and, closer to home, the American family. The cluster bombing, the machine gun fire, the slapping helicopter blades, the screaming napalm victims. Hendrix himself had been a candidate for duty in Vietnam, having enlisted in the U.S. Army at the age of 18 and been assigned to the 101st Airborne Division at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. He never made it to the field of battle. An indifferent soldier, he was honorably discharged following an ankle injury on a training jump. A few weeks after the Woodstock Music and Arts Fair, the cultural event in upstate New York that would define a generation, Hendrix made a rare appearance on a television talk show, sitting down with interviewer Dick Cavett, for his primetime ABC program. When Cavett asked about the controversy the guitarist's rendition of the national anthem had evoked, Hendrix replied, "I don't know, man. I'm American, and so I played it. They made me sing it in school, so it was a flashback." Persisting gently, Cavett noted the unorthodoxy of Hendrix's approach to the song. "That's not unorthodox," the soft-spoken musician responded. "I thought it was beautiful." So I go on from there. This is in the introduction to the book before I get into the issues, the specific issues. But I go on from there to tell another story about Johnny Cash going to, does that say 3 minutes? I don't have my glasses on. I go into another story about Johnny Cash accepting Richard Nixon's invitation to come perform at the White House. And Nixon asked him to play a couple of cornball country music songs that actually weren't even Cash's, but Nixon knew them. And Cash said, "You know what, I got a couple of other ideas." So he came, he sang one or two of the songs that Nixon wanted, but he also sang this, which, so I'm sure plenty of you are familiar with lots of Johnny Cash songs, maybe not so much this one, so I'll just play a snippet of it. This is a sort of an anti-war song by Johnny Cash that he sang at the White House, which was written in the spirit of trying to understand what the kids who were a younger generation than his were arguing about when they were talking about the Vietnam War.
The old man turned off the radio, said, "Where did all of the old songs go? Kids sure play funny music these days. They play it in the strangest way. Said, it looks to me like they've all gone wild. It was peaceful back when I was a child. Well, man, could it be that the girls and boys are trying to be heard above your noise? And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth?"
The lonely voice of youth cries, "What is truth?" So just briefly, I'll just say that each chapter has a few songs aligned with the issue that we're talking about. Like, for instance, the first chapter is about the nonviolence movement, and I talk about Country Joe McDonald's Fixin' to Die rag, the chant that he started at Woodstock, which was, sort of an iconic moment in the anti-Vietnam era. But I also talk about a song from the First World War that was actually a hit song called "I Didn't Raise My Boy to Be a Soldier," which was an anti-war song before America became involved in the European theater of that war. In the Civil Rights chapter, I talk about "Strange Fruit." Obviously, Time magazine called it the number one song of the century. But I also talk about Curtis Mayfield, who wrote a bunch of amazing pop songs in the 60s, in which he sort of snuck civil rights ideas and thoughts onto mainstream radio. In the women's rights chapter, I talk about Aretha Franklin's "Respect," but I also talk about Leslie Gore's "You Don't Own Me," which is nobody's idea of a protest song, but it absolutely is if you listen to the words. It's about, a teenage girl telling her teenage boyfriend, "We can hang out, but you can't tell me what to wear. You can't tell me if I can see other boys. You don't own me." And that song, 10 years after she sang it, became an anthem for the women's movement in the 1970s, sort of inadvertently. She didn't plan it that way, and the writers didn't plan it that way. So those are examples of what I tried to do with this book, and we will discuss a little more in a few minutes. So thanks for listening.
We're going to warm up with Bonnie's introduction, and then it'll be up. I'm going to will it that way. Bonnie is a New York-based graphic designer and founder of the award-winning studio 8 and a Half, which has clients including HBO, Saturday Night Live, and Late Night with Seth Meyers. And before that, she co-founded the design studio Number 17, which created the titles for Will and Grace. I was very excited about that. Graphic Design USA declared Sigler as one of the 50 most influential designers today, and she was the creative director of the Trump parody memoir, You Can't Spell America Without Me, in collaboration with Alec Baldwin and Kurt Anderson. Moreover, she is the author of Dear Client, a guidebook on working with creatives. Her most recent release, Signs of Resistance, which we're talking about today, is a visual history of American protests from the 18th century until present day, which the Newark Star-Ledger calls a crash course in how quintessentially American it is to protest. Bonnie Sigler.
You did will it to come back up. Okay. Thank you, everybody, and thank you. This festival is amazing, and for pairing me up with James was absolutely perfect. So since the election, that's really what turned me around, turned me into an activist, big time. I've been obsessed with the history of protest in America, and I was really trying to figure out what I could do. So what had Americans done in past times, especially designers, when confronted with difficult times? What did people do to make their voice heard as a way to inform me what I could now do? So that led to the book, which, like James's book, is divided into images from different protest movements throughout history. And I'm going to show you images from a few of the chapters in a really quick ride through our collective history. It's kind of, this is like the talk equivalent of just thumbing through the book. So the oldest image I have in the book is from 1754. And what's really crazy about this is probably you guys recognize it. It's 265 years old, and that's a really powerful image that stays around for that long. And it really, and it was a protest illustration. Benjamin Franklin did it to accompany his own article in his own paper. But he was really smart because he used one strong, simple image and as few words as possible, and that stays in people's minds, and you'll see it over and over. Immigration, so in the 1850s is when our country began to deal with immigration as a bad thing. There was a party who, this was their flag, they called themselves the Know Nothing Party, and they thought nobody else should get to come in from any other country. So they feared immigrants for the exact same reason, you know, the made-up reasons we fear immigrants today, like racism and fear of job loss, which, of course, is completely not true. It continued nonetheless. This is an image of the melting pot and the one element that won't mix, which in this case, in this illustration, is the Irish. But it really got baked in throughout our history, and over the last 200 years, every single immigrant group, every single ethnic group has been targeted at one point or another. The Irish, the Chinese, the Germans, Jews, non-whites, Mormons, Italians. This cartoon shows how to dispose of Italians. Every ethnic group, the Catholics, and this was how successful they were. And this next, this is, that was slow. This is one of my favorite protest signs regarding immigration. Every single American is one of these four things. There are no other choices. And if people would only realize this, we would be a lot happier. Okay, women have been marching for a really long time. We began the fight for the vote in 1848 at Seneca Falls, and we didn't get the vote until 1920. That's 72 years of marching. I've been marching for 3 years, and I'm exhausted. So they all wore their sashes to self-identify. We then had our pink pussy hats. They had their sashes. And this was a really popular way to communicate what was going on with suffrage. They would make these maps and show which countries had adopted the right for women to vote in state elections, not in federal until 1920, but over time, state by state, adopted it. And it's crazy how the entire West part of the country adopted the right to vote before a single state on the East was even talking about it. This is a symbol it wasn't the civil rights movement then, it was abolition. This was created in 1787. And it became the symbol of the emancipation movement back then. And it just says, am I not a man and a brother? The man is on his knees, in chain, non-threatening, just imploring someone to recognize his dignity. And then 180 years later, this same exact message had to be used again and again. This was at the sanitation march in Memphis. This is all the protesters together holding their sign. It's so powerful. And then this sign was recently used to bring attention to the horror on the border, where children are being treated inhumanely to this day. And they also understood the power of multiples, of seeing this large group of people holding the same sign. So Vietnam was really when designers and artists were like, wait, this thing I do for corporations, I can do it to express myself. The thing that's so cool about protest posters to me is nobody asks someone to make a protest poster. People do it because they have to. Their client is their conscience. They have to express themselves. And that really happened for artists and designers during Vietnam. There's signs like this. If you think about it, it's really true. Everybody, I'm sure, recognizes this. This was drawn by a woman in California. Her name was Lorraine Schneider, and she had a son of drafting age. So she was part of a group of moms who would get together. They were called Another Mother for Peace. And she drew this, and it was a Mother's Day card. It wasn't a poster or a button or anything. And they sent it to all the politicians in Washington. And on the inside of the card, it said, I don't want candy or flowers. I want an end to killing. We who have given life must be dedicated to preserving it. And in 1970, after the Ohio National Guard shot and killed four students at Kent State, a group of activists got together in Berkeley with a mission to use art as a protest weapon. And they printed like 600 signs on whatever material they could do, all silkscreen. But the crazy thing is, if you were in Berkeley in 1970, you would have seen these, but you wouldn't see them anywhere else. And that's the power we have today, is I can post something and it can be seen around the world. I didn't even know about these posters until I started doing research.
The date on that is 1973. Can you explain that?
No, you know what? That's a crazy code. It's 4973, and it's on all the posters because it was a message to the police. They made a deal with the police to not take them down. So if the posters had 4973 on it, they had permission to stay up.
Where?
In Berkeley, California, just in Berkeley. This is another one that I love so much. Okay, women's equality. 50 years after we won the right to vote, we were marching again. This was to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the 20th Amendment, and it was a women's strike for equality, equal pay. 50 years ago. We still don't have equality. And this was an organization called the Chicago Women's Collective, and they were considered a really radical organization because they held workshops in women's leadership, health education, and safety. So they were constantly being shut down, and they were making posters like this. The AIDS crisis presented another urgent call for action, as again, the government was ignoring what was happening in the country. And the social activism around AIDS single-handedly changed the awareness around the issue and force the government to act. So this is what, if you were a homosexual, you had to wear in concentration camps to identify yourself. So what ACT UP and Grand Fury did was they took that symbol and turned it upside down. They made it proactive. They were proud to be gay. They were proud to wear this symbol as opposed to it being a negative, which is what the Nazis wanted it to be. So combined with silence equals death, which was literally true, this became the most powerful image of the era. And Keith Haring became synonymous with AIDS activism. He was already a famous artist when the crisis began, but he did whatever he could to get the word out and made thousands of pieces of art about it before he died of AIDS. Reagan was especially negligent, criminally so, and this was created for Colors magazine by Tibor Kalman, and it shows what Ronald Reagan would look like if he had AIDS, which is to say, like anyone else with AIDS, except that they would find a cure.
I knew Tibor.
Cool. I don't think this is meant to be a conversation. this is the most heartbreaking image in the book for me, these two girls and their sign, and that they're holding popsicle sticks, and it's really true. They really have to wonder if they're next. This is an amazing poster designed by Andre Carrillo. This photo of a young woman during a Black Lives Matter protest in Louisiana won a lot of prizes for how amazing this photograph was. She's so beautiful and elegant, and has no weapons, and these robocops are approaching her like she's dangerous. But the crazy thing about it is how reminiscent it is of this photo from 50 years earlier. the absurdity of the military coming out for nonviolent protests. Look at how close they are. And these two women are fearless, and they refuse to be intimidated by these... fill in the blank with whatever you want. Okay, Trump, this is the fun part. So a lot of artists saw this symbol, and when Trump was elected, immediately saw the possibilities. So, you know, memes have become a kind of the new form of poster. And so I'm going to show you a few memes, because it's really healthy to mock Trump. So this was called Tiny Trump. And the people who made this meme said, other people, go make your own Tiny Trumps. And each one was at a slightly different scale. But it's really reflective of, you know, what a small, small man he is. This was a poster by a guy named Mike Matthews, who made it as he was 22, I think, when he made it. But I just thought it was the best campaign poster I saw. This is Marilyn Mittner. A lot of artists started using their power to challenge Trump and express their anger. So she made this bronze plank of the Access Hollywood transcript. And believe it or not, it's worse to read. And she wanted these to be hung outside every government building. I know. Okay, I'm just going to keep going. There's nothing to say. You all know. Okay, so I love this one. I don't know, graphic designers know this, but that was the logo for Trump Pence for 24 hours before everybody said that it looked like the T was fucking the P. And they were like, oh, shit, and they took it down and came up with something new. Trump did come up with this unbelievably effective icon. It struck a perfect note with his base, and it was a con to make them think he was like them, except really he only wears baseball caps outside because, you know, his hair, you don't know what's going to happen with the wind. But it was so iconic, it was parodied to great effect. Over and over. This is where I used to, and this is the in the book, the last one, but then I found this one in a store the other day. Okay, but we had more hats, and the pussy hat was our answer to the red cap. And like so many great acts of resistance before us, we took his words about grabbing pussies and appropriated them and made them empowering instead of disgusting. And all over the Women's March, the day after the inauguration, women were screaming this from the rooftops, which was so great. This one is very effective. Because you can feel her anger. You know the whole time she was making it. And there were new creative forms of protest. This is projected on Trump's International Hotel in D.C. And they had a truck that projected on the building. And if the police came, they drove away. So it was really effective. They got fancier over time. Okay, this next thing, I swear, I was in Grand Central Station and choose a Wi-Fi network came up, and this is what it was. This is an example of people just, you know, they have to make everything about this and show that they're not taking it anymore. I didn't like that they spelled Mueller wrong, but I'm picky. There's stuff like this. When a computer tries to determine whether you're a computer. And, I mean, this is like social activism at its best. Look at that. This one is in the window of a bookstore. Please note the post-apocalyptic fiction section has been moved to current affairs. And one more. But you know, if you walk around during your day and you encounter the people's anger, I mean, it gives us hope to know that other people are feeling the same way. And this next series, a guy, I love that he did this. He wanted to show how the founding fathers were reacting to Trump being in the White House. There's more. And this one. This is by Gary Taxali. This has won a lot of awards. I see that when I see the flag now. And some people think it's the stripes are like bent, like our core values are bent. And other people think it means this is what's been lurking there all along, which is really how I see it. But activism has worked. It has changed hearts and minds. And we've survived incredibly difficult times, of which I just gave you a glimpse. So we just have to do what we've always done, which is keep fighting. And every single person has to get involved. Stand up and speak out. Thank you. Okay. You're in the middle.
Well, that was great, of course. I enjoyed both of your books. I really wanted you to... The one song I wanted you to play was Which Side Are You On?
Oh, I can jump up and play it.
Would you jump up and play it? Because it's so iconic.
Yeah,
and
sure. I'm just going to do it, yeah.
Okay. And the reason I want you to do that is because my question...
Come on, you
got it?
Yeah, go ahead. Do you, I'll tell... How the good old Union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? We're starting our good battle. We know we're sure to win. Because we've got the gun thugs a-looking very thin. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Good.
Okay.
So can I tell a quick story
please.
About this? So,
yes, that was leading into that.
Right. So that's Florence Reese. She, in the 1930s, during the coal mine strikes, her family was heavily involved. Her husband was an organizer for the union. And as the story goes, she calls them thugs right in the song, you know, and she actually names the guy whose company they were the union was organizing against, J.H. Blair. His name is actually immortalized in that song. But the thugs for Blair were trying to suppress the creation of unionized workers, and they were raiding homes of the organizers, the union organizers, including Florence Reese's husband. And he wasn't there at the time for some reason. Maybe he knew that they were coming, I don't know. But she was there with her kids. And they ransacked the house and turned everything upside down looking for evidence that he was a union affiliate or organizer. And so Florence Reese was so furious at the time that she supposedly was looking for a piece of paper, couldn't find one, ripped the back off of a calendar on the wall, sat down and wrote all the words to that song in one blurt right after the thugs left. And then 40 years later, in Barbara Koppel's great documentary about the continuing coal mine strikes, she had Florence Reese come to one of the meetings to perform the song herself. The coal mine, the coal strikes are just sort of the most obvious, from a mainstream perspective, the most obvious of all of the workers' rights demonstrations and protests that we've seen in this country for 150 years. And there's tons of great songs about coal mine strikes. But that's sort of the quintessential example, and that's where obviously the title of the book comes from.
Well, I wanted you to play that because... my question is about how some of these songs just continue on, but not connected. And you make the point to the original protest. Mm-hmm. So Billy Bragg was here
right.
a few weeks ago, and he was down at the Battery Wharf. There's a, right. There's a protest going on with hotel workers,
right.
and that's the song he sang.
Yeah.
So we are here today in 2019, and that song
yeah.
continues on, and it's applicable along the way.
Right.
And I'm wondering, in your research, are you finding that people have any sense of where many of these songs came from, or they just accept them as, you know, that's what you would sing in this moment, or it seems
good.
You'd
be surprised. I mean, yeah. So the song that I mentioned earlier about nonviolent activism in the run-up to World War I, I Didn't Raise My Boy to Be a Soldier, I actually came across that song not from that era, but from the 60s, when there was a band like this kind of weird, you know, not especially popular band from, I think, Cleveland, but from Ohio somewhere, who... They were called the Eli Radish Band. Anybody out there an Eli Radish Band fan? Anyway, they were on the verge of breaking out. They were a little too weird to break out into the mainstream, but they opened for the Doors and whoever, a couple of other big bands, and kind of, you know, didn't quite make it, and then it crumbled for them. But they were on a major label, and they put out an entire album of songs from the World War I era that were anti-war protest songs, including I Didn't Raise My Boy to Be a Soldier, just to show that they were absolutely familiar with the legacy and the history, and they were making the connection, very distinct connection across 50 years, that people were doing this 50 years ago, just as Bonnie said in so many of these images. People were doing, you know, with the women's rights movement, people were doing this 150 years ago, people were doing it again 50 years ago, and we still have to do it today.
Our country is based on protest.
Yes. It's just in the ways that you all have chosen to articulate that protest, it's interesting to me to see those ongoing connections. Every year I do a Christmas song thing with one of our engineers who collects funky holiday songs, and you would be amazed at the number of ones that are anti-war Christmas songs.
Because they want the soldiers home for Christmas.
Yeah, and they do, and they're very sneaky kind of lyrics that got kind of a little beat, and you're going along, and you're like, what? In the middle of it. So, is it true, this is a question for both of you, that some of the iconic ones that we know about, like the Which Side Are You On, like the I Am a Man, that they just continue on and on, whether or not people know where they come from, but they seem to have kind of a soul connection that seem appropriate for the time? Or are there others that you can think of that are just in that time period and maybe they might be seen again, but they seemed for that moment, for that time?
There are so many that are used again and again, like Uncle Sam and Rosie the Riveter, both of which have origins that you would be shocked by, or Keep Calm and Carry On, which was actually never seen in England during World War II. Never. They decided it was too scary, and they didn't want to post it and tell people, while the bombs are dropping, keep calm and carry on. But we like it as this nostalgia for what it was like, and the Queen posted this message for everybody. It's a complete lie. So there's all these nostalgic falsehoods, and we still love them despite that. Like Rosie the Riveter was not about women's empowerment or women working in the factories at all. It was just made for Westinghouse break rooms to encourage factory workers to keep working. That was it. It hung in a break room for 2 weeks and disappeared for 40 years. And somebody found it in the 60s and was like, or the 80s rather, and was like, hey, I'm gonna put this on a button or a t-shirt. And then they called it Rosie the Riveter. It had nothing to do with Rosie the Riveter. Everything is fake about it. But I'm always fascinated by that. And I think why people use those famous images is because it gives you, like, the familiarity invites you in, and then you mess with it, and you get to get your message across. But you've already won someone over by going, essentially, oh, I know that.
Right. Mm.
And so it's like seeing a friend or a relative. You're familiar with them, and then you pile on what you want to say.
But what's interesting to me is that I do a lot of talking on college campuses, and I do have to do so much parenthetical speak. So you know Bonnie Siegler, well, she once ran this thing and she created the graphics for, and then I can say what the hell else is going on. So there is not a lot of history connected to some of these things that we may think there are.
Absolutely.
So I'm fascinated by who are the griots that are carrying the image of I Am a Man to the place where it would be I Am a Child now. How does that happen?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's some fabulous graphic designer. It's somebody who knew the power of that image. I mean, to me, the association between the abolition image and I Am a Man was I mean, the abolition image was created in London.
Yes.
And then this was in Memphis. Like, how, you know, but essentially they took three words out of that original thing. I don't know if there was any real connection between them 200 years apart.
But that's, well, that's
that sign hangs on my wall, by the way.
I am a man?
Yes, because I am from Memphis.
Yeah.
So right. That is wherever I go, that sign is on my wall.
But that's what we have. Yeah. That's what we have books and now the internet for. So
yeah.
People can find these things out. So one of the ideas behind my book was to hopefully entice some high school and college sort of American studies or music professors, but you know, American popular studies type classes to assign the book to the students. And in the my book came out in January, so I've had the opportunity to do a bunch of events around it, and the best events have been full of students. And you know, I actually I have a friend who's a high school social studies teacher, and he invited me to his high school on an evening, not to a class, an evening event. And I said, Tom, seriously, are you expecting high school kids to come see this old guy talk about old music that they're not familiar with? And he said, oh, they're coming. And there were 100 kids there, mostly from that one high school. There were a handful of adults, and he opened it to the community, but really it was mostly the high school students, and they were deeply engaged, and they wanted to know more. And they did know, you know, when I played a bunch of songs, they, you know, if I played Dylan, I'd say, how many of you recognize this voice? And most of them would say, yeah, kind of, but like yeah. They sort of knew, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's not a total vacuum, you know? I mean, and, you know, it's just how the culture works. I mean, obviously we're inundated with everything now. So,
yeah.
You know, all the stuff that came before us, in addition to all the stuff that's swirling around us on a daily basis right now, is all right there at your fingertips now.
Well, your comment about memes really struck me, because when I was going through your book, I kept thinking, wow, some of these posters are kind of, the memes are the posters of today in this way.
Absolutely.
And I must see a billion of those a day.
I know.
You know? So most of us.
But some of them
exposed.
Stick and some of them don't.
Yeah.
I mean, some of them, like the Gary Taxali, the flag one, like it's literally, if I see American flag now, that's what I see. He changes the way I look at the symbol of our country. That's pretty powerful.
Yes. So my question to you too, in doing this work, what piece did you come across, what sign or what song, where the history surprised you, where there was something you did not know about its connection?
Probably Rosie for me, because I pretty much assumed I knew, just like everybody assumes they knew. That was crazy. And then the Uncle Sam thing is that it was a poster in England, and then we just ripped it off. So it wasn't even...
Sort of like The Office.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Like, so much good stuff.
Yeah.
I was really surprised, but I love finding out. I mean, I love the history of how these things came to be, why, who paid for it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For you?
I guess for me, she's holding up the sign that we have a minute, and then we're
yes.
going to take audience
okay.
questions, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, she just gave us three. Wow, that was funny. She
okay.
went from 1 minute to 3 minutes. That's amazing.
Okay.
I think for me, I mean, I'll mention an example of a song that basically helped kickstart the environmental movement 50 years ago with the first Earth Day. I just love this story, and it's so, like, so one of the things that I set out to do with the book, as I mentioned earlier, was to show the extremely broad range of types of music that can fall under the umbrella of what constitutes protest music if you're looking for it. And this one is sort of like the most far out under, you know, almost outside completely of the umbrella, but still under there. Right around 1970, a couple of oceanographic researchers discovered that they were the first to discover that whales actually communicate with each other. And so they were the first to record whale songs.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did they record it, but it became a hit record. So some of you might remember this, but like in college campuses in the 1970s, this album of whale songs, just whale songs, was a hit record that sold a couple hundred thousand copies. Then it got republished a few years later. And the whole thing, the idea of Save the Whales and the idea that whales are sentient beings like we are and that they have lives and relationships and connections to each other, completely helped kick off the whole environmental movement. And it's just such a weird story, but I also love the idea that, you know, I was able to sneak in, you know, whale songs into my book.
No, I love it. I love it.
Can I tell a 30-second
sure.
whale song story?
Okay.
This is the power of design. There's a long escalator in Washington, D.C. subway system that made a horrible
yeah.
sound
yeah.
when it went, you know, you can imagine the horrible sound. And people were complaining about it. And then some brilliant person put a sign at the bottom of the escalator that said, "Enjoy the sounds of whales talking to each other." Yeah. And all of a sudden, nobody complained.
Like, yeah, I love it. Right.
That's very funny. So my last question before we take other questions is, what has been curated from the signs or songs of protest that goes around the world? I am familiar with, for example, having done a documentary on the civil rights movement, "We Shall Overcome" is everywhere.
Right.
And it's popped up all over the world and continues to do so. And a few other civil rights songs I could mention as well. But can you name a song, and can you name a poster?
I just recently came across a story that some of you probably also came across, the Hong Kong protests. I was kind of wondering what songs they were singing. And there's an English hymn, a Christian hymn, that I can't remember the name of it, but I'll have to look it up again after we're done tonight. But that they're singing because there's some kind of religious exemption to singing in public. Protest songs that they were singing, automatically lock them up, take them away. They're not allowed to do that in a gathering. But, you know, religious music is okay. Mm. So they took to singing this very simple Christian hymn.
Interesting.
And it's not specifically protest, but just the fact that they're able to do it means that
is
they're
a protest.
That's the protest.
Right. That's
and,
right.
And just to you know, segue into the graphic design portion, I just heard over the last day or so that I think it was on the Marco Werman's show. About how the protesters are carrying little stuffed animals as a symbol of their protest, which is the Pepe. Meme,
yeah.
Talking about memes.
Yes,
and Pepe
right.
was this, for those of you who don't know, was this little frog meme, or
that's
still
right.
is,
that's right.
that the arch right-wingers, the hardcore right-wingers, used as a symbol of their own movement a few years ago. And
I still do. No, I think it's still
do.
Yeah.
And for some weird reason, it got. And I'm very curious why, because the Hong Kong protesters know that, like, they're using it as a symbol of their own protest, and that's obviously a liberal protest.
So they're just co-opting it.
Co-opting.
Yeah.
It, right.
Yeah. Is there a...
I don't know. I really went deep American back to the 18th century, so I don't know. But I love the things like the Yellow Jackets. And I mean, I think those are so powerful. Again, the Pussy Hats, and they did the Yellow Jackets. And when groups of people agree on the symbol that they're going to use, it's just so amazing.
It is. All right, so now we have time for your questions. And let me emphasize that. Questions, not your statements, your questions. Okay.
So I think the organizers want you to come up to and talk into the mic if you can.
Yes. So I see a lady here in the green. Are you going to go to the mic? Yes, you. No, you. You had your hand. No, the lady behind you.
Somebody back there.
Oh, I thought you had your hand up. Okay.
Somebody
all
back
right.
there had her hand up.
Okay.
Yep.
Oh, go to the mic for your question.
Yes. First of all, I want to apologize for my unexpected interruption earlier.
No worries.
Well played. I wonder. I don't think there are posters, a lot of visual art in reaction to Trump, but there isn't a lot of protest music in response to Trump. And I wonder if you could comment on that. And is it because we don't have the same kind of movement with which protest music has often been associated and been an outgrowth of?
Yeah, I think it's because the target is shifting every single day.
Yeah.
I think that's mostly it. But I would say that if you look around for it, I mean, just I'll give you one example. In the end of my book is sort of the idea of the book was to go through the 20th century and the progressive movements and the music that applied to them in America. But the last chapter is sort of a catch up from, okay, what's happened from 2000 till now. And I kind of went back through each of the movements and said, here's an example of a song that applies to that's been popularized over the last handful of years. And so the Hamilton soundtrack has a song called "Immigrants, We Get the Job Done."
That's right.
And that has become kind of, you know, a popular, and actually I just saw, we were just talking about this other Broadway show called Hadestown, which won all the Tonys this year, and there's a song in that was written 13 years ago by Anais Mitchell, who's a great folk singer from Vermont, who now has her show on Broadway. The song is called "Why We Build the Wall," and it's, you know, it's the devil. It's actually the devil singing to his minions, and he's teaching them to sort of parrot what he's saying, which is, well, we build the wall because we have stuff. We have some, we have some affluence and some security, and the people that we want to keep out don't have it, and they want what we have, so we want to build this wall. She wrote the song 13 years ago, and,
wow.
you know, she, I've interviewed her for the Globe a couple times, or when the show was coming out, and she's sort of dumbfounded. Wow, this song took on a life of its own. And that's how these things happen. You know, they get written for one reason, and then they take on a life of their own because suddenly someone says, "Wow, that is really speaking directly to something that, you know, the president just did or said yesterday."
Well, and didn't Bob Dylan always say he never wrote a protest song?
Yeah.
So yeah. There's another good example.
That's true.
Right.
Okay. Right.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Hi.
So I have two questions that are somewhat related. So I am a marketing manager, and I also work at a university in the area, Boston University. And one of my questions is, on social media specifically, I find, at least with the people that I associate with or I'm friends with, it's very easy to jump on board on a topic and protest against that topic. And my question to you is, how do you approach that situation when a person jumps on board on something and they don't do their research mm-hmm. on that and know the full story? Because it has come into the news where people, you know, start attacking a certain group or person or whatever, mm-hmm. and then it ends up being a different story a day later. So that's question one. And then question two would be, how do you approach the situation where protest stops discussion? When, you know, at the university, plenty of times people invite other people that may not, a group of people may not agree with, and then protest starts on campuses.
Right.
Where I find that campuses should be a spot where you are meant to discuss and learn different views and see the okay. better solution.
Got it.
So I'll answer that one briefly. Callie mentioned Billy Bragg, who I really love, and I've interviewed him several times over the years. And I didn't include him in the book only because I made the point that, you know, I could have talked about all kinds of international protest music, Billy Bragg, The Clash, Bob Marley, Victor Jara from Chile, martyred songwriter from the 70s, but did not. I just chose to focus on American culture and American music. But Billy Bragg, he actually has covered Why We Build the Wall from Hadestown. He's also obviously sings Woody Guthrie songs all the time, and Which Side Are You On? Mm-hmm. And he had a talk in Cambridge recently because he has a new book out called The Three Elements of Freedom, The Three Something of Freedom. And he makes a great point about that campus argument, which is, you know, that's a tricky one for me because I also wrote a book about George Carlin, and I've always been sort of a free speech absolutist, but he makes the point that free speech obviously comes with consequences. If you say something that's offensive to someone else and they clap back at you, that's, you know, it's your right to say it, but it's also their right to clap back at you, and those are the consequences you're taking by you know, saying your piece. So the campus free speech issue is a prickly one, but his argument, he tries to simplify it as much as he can, and he just talks about how there are boundaries to free speech. You cannot publish, I can't publish Callie's home address and phone number because I'm mad at her for the question that she asked me. You know, I can't threaten her online. You know, there are boundaries to free speech, and he says that, you know, the argument is that the campus free speech issue, there are boundaries. So it's a great opportunity for that discussion to be had. You know, we all need to know that everybody has the chance to speak, but if you're coming with an absolutist idea about what you're, what it's okay for you to say, that, you know, you have to accept that there are boundaries.
And just yesterday or the day before yesterday, a guy has to pay $450,000 for writing a book saying that Sandy Hook children were never killed.
Right.
It never happened. And the father of one of those children has been following that for years, and he has to play restitution. Did you want to respond to that?
You know, my feeling about all those kinds of protests is the same as the response to somebody who's against gay marriage, which is, then don't get gay married.
exactly.
Like, if you don't want to hear someone speak, you don't even want to hear what they have to say, don't go.
Right.
That's it.
All right. Yeah. All right. Her first part of her question was about, and I always said stop, I just want them to make sure you address this. If you don't know the history of something and yet you're responding to it.
I mean, you shouldn't, I mean, people shouldn't be ignorant. And if you can educate them, then there's your opportunity. I don't know where you went.
Yeah.
There you are.
Why we wrote these two books. Throw our little drop in the ocean.
The opportunity. If someone is truly ignorant because they're just watching Fox News, then you can teach them.
Mm-hmm. All right, that's the end of our session. That means you leave here, go to the table to get to buy the books so that they can sign them on your way to texting book to support.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.